Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 573. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Chris.
It's weird that I just said hello to you since we've been sitting across from each other for a while.
Yeah.
It's the illusion that this just happened.
I always like to think they're just thinking of us floating in a void.
Until we start talking to them.
Yeah.
And we actually don't even really exist.
Yeah. We're just pure. We're the perfect computer program that's creating all podcasts. These are all synthesized voices.
You just blew my synthesized mind.
Yeah, and I just became self-aware.
What does that mean?
That as part of the computer program, that knows it's part of the computer program.
All right, well, since you're self-aware, you should trim that beard and get a haircut.
All right, I'm going to go rogue like Lore.
What?
Data's brother, the bad one.
Yeah, why? Really?
Right?
Is it time for Evil Kyle?
Oh, that'd be good. But Evil Kyle would have no beard. That'd be weird.
Would you be...
Let's see what my chin looks like.
Kyle Clark, or would your evil twin be Clark Kyle?
Yeah, oh, yeah. For sure. That's definitely how that happens.
Oh, that's fantastic. This episode is Robert Patrick, who I'd worked with once before, and...
You were both superheroes.
We were both superheroes. He was Hawkman, I was Green Arrow, and...
I love how casually you can toss that off.
Isn't that nice?
That amazing sentence.
That was pretty fun.
He was Hawkman, I was Green Arrow.
Literally! Well, the cartoon literally. But I didn't really get to talk to him much that day, because we were all working in a group, and... right from the get-go, fucking coolest guy in the world.
Super cool dude.
And with amazing stories. Robert Patrick, he's one of my new favorite people.
Yeah, mine too.
And we captured his soul temporarily for about an hour and change
here. The digitized version of it exists within the podcast matrix. That.
Oh, yeah, this is part of the extension.
We're getting
of
real
the
William Gibson up in here today.
The digital consciousness, the reality that is swirling around in your brain that may or may not have actually existed. But as long as you feel like you had the memory of it,
then it's real.
Then it's as real as possible.
It's like a Total Recall.
Kind Get of your ass to Mars.
There we go.
Robert Patrick is promoting the television show Scorpion, which premieres Monday, September 22nd at 9 p.m. on CBS. And here's right now on our podcast, number 573, with Robert Patrick.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
McPhee says, hey.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Catherine
McPhee.
She was...
My co-star.
She was in... we did Rock of Ages together.
That's what she said.
Yeah, she was basically... Oh, the Catherine McPhee story is amazing. She was basically just like a backup singer. And her voice clearly like blew everyone else away. Like when in a chorus of people, you could spot... You knew who she was.
Right.
And we went away for a couple months, and when we came back to do the show again, the live show again, Rock of Ages, they were like, oh, Catherine can't be on it. She's on American Idol. And we're like, what? I mean, it made sense because her voice is amazing, and now she's like Catherine McPhee.
Yeah, yeah. So, I had no idea. I didn't really know much about her. But my wife and my daughter said, oh, yeah, she's American Island. She did this show, Smash. And neither one of those I happened to watch. But then when my 82-year-old man chimed in, oh, yeah, that Cat McPhee.
I tell you what, there.
I'm going to watch that show.
You know, that's your Georgia coming out right
that's
there.
It.
Hey, I tell you what, there, son.
Boy, I tell you, I'll watch that show.
I'm going to watch that show.
You going to give me a headshot?
You going
to. He's forever, and every time I talk to him, he's like, Did you get my headshot? Yeah. Sign it to me.
Sign it to
Big Bob.
Make that.
Sign it to Big Bob.
Is that the inner Robert Patrick Big Bob? Is that the
Big Bobby? Big Bobby.
Yeah, I was little Bobby for so many years growing up in Georgia, and you know, my father's Robert, and I can fall back on that character quite a few, you know, quite a bit.
It's funny
Big
because
Bob.
Big Bob. Because I grew up in the South too, and I'm
where are
not,
you from?
Tennessee, Memphis.
Oh no, I love Memphis.
It's a good town.
It's a great town. We shot, and she was there. We shot Walk the Line there.
Oh, yeah, well, of course.
And Isaac Hayes and Stax were there. Yeah. Oh yeah, Isaac Hayes. That's right. Yeah. Sue, the lady I'm referencing here Sue. On the radio is Sue Patricolo,
who was also sitting in the background for the Sean Bean podcast as well. So she's no stranger to Nerdist podcast.
She's no stranger. It's a podcast.
It is a podcast.
This is a new whole realm for me, Chris.
Yes, it's basically it's a loose conversation about whatever the fuck we want to talk
That's
about.
That's awesome.
But yeah, so Memphis, which you shot,
Walked the Line, and I shot a Elvis the miniseries with Johnny Rhys Meyers.
Yeah,
and we actually shot on Graceland. And
oh wow, that must have been that's awesome. That's not easy to do.
Yeah, no, the estate was behind it, and I love that city.
It's a good town.
All the streetcars, they were doing the restoration in downtown.
They were trying to bring it back. Memphis fell into something of a disrepair for a while. It was a little, it was a little bit of a, it just needed to be clean, like spruced up a bit. And they really did. And so a lot of it, it's cool now and people can hang out there.
And you were born there.
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, but I grew up in Memphis.
Yeah. Right on.
But that voice, it's sort of like you said, that Big Bob voice, like a lot of times the voice in my head is this guy. Hey there, son. What you doing there, boy? Like I hear that. That's the voice I hear in my head a lot of the time, even though I haven't lived there for 2 decades.
Yeah. It's fun to draw back on. There's so many guys that when I was growing up, my baseball coach, his accent, he's kind of one of those high-pitched Southerners. Bobby, get on over here. Now. I told you to throw your bow your neck out there, son. Come on now.
The funny thing about those guys is a lot of times they're like big overweight guys, but they have these like, hey there, son, what you guys are? Come on down and everybody pull up a chair. Yeah. It's like the guy with a giant bib with a plate of ribs. But he's got the highest pitch voice and that,
Yeah.
I like the South. I've poked fun at the South a lot over the years, but in a way that is I love it though. I love going back.
I love the South. I love the heritage, and it's funny when you come to Hollywood, you kind of try not to play into that Southern accent that you have or your heritage in a way, because people out here can kind of assume that you're just Gomer Pyle for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? You want to be taken serious, so you kind of put it on the, try to lose it as fast as you can and have just a Midwestern accent.
Right. Because obviously, I'm sure that audition would have gone a lot different if you were like, I'm looking for John Connor. And they're like, not really sure.
Yeah.
This is the right guy. Where's that boy? I'm a goddamn Terminator.
Yeah.
What you looking at?
What the hell? Have you seen this boy? Yeah, it wouldn't have worked. There's a little bit of the southern draw in there, but you lose that quick when you want to be taken serious out here. You kind of distance yourself, I think. I don't know, personally.
Well, it's just that they'll put you in a box if they think, oh, that's all that guy does. They would rather know that you can do it if you need to, but you don't just do that.
Yeah. I like going back to it. The southern accent is fun to go back to.
The True Blood guy.
Well, the True Blood guy. Yeah, you've done your homework there. Yeah, True Blood was funny when I went to the read through for that. There's so many actors that are European on the show doing southern accents that I remember the table read. I think they kind of took notice of, damn, that sounds good. That's an authentic Southern accent right there.
How did you get that accent?
How do you do that?
That's interesting.
I want to do, I'm working with a guy, I haven't been working that much lately with him, but Jerry Grinnell, who's a dialect coach from Ireland. He's a very good one. He works with Johnny Depp and other people for accents. And I want to learn a standard English traditional European accent so that I can start to try to go do...
Start taking some work away from them.
Taking some work away from Europeans, exactly.
They're coming over here.
I think it'd be worthy. But that's a tough dialect to do,
It's tough because I think...
Accent.
We can sort of do a general British accent, but I'm sure that if you were to really dissect it, be like, no, that word was from this region and this word was from that region. What is the actual... To them, all the accents sound completely different.
Yeah, they can distinguish between a Cockney accent and an upper crust. I try to do it whenever, I don't know about you, but when I'm around people that have the accent, I immediately try to start mimicking them. It drives them crazy.
Which they love, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they hate it, But most of the time they're trying to do an American accent, so they're mimicking me.
But it's got to be just as hard for them to... distinguish between Georgia, Texas, Tennessee, you know, like Mississippi, like the drawl varies, yeah, and the intonations vary a bit. I'm not even sure I could discern all of them.
Yeah. I'm not sure I could either. You know, like the New Orleans accent is actually rooted deep with it's more of an Irish accent that kind of evolved over the years. And that, you know, wow, what a hybrid, doing an Irish accent, southern version of a New Orleans accent, which is probably one of the most difficult ones to really try to pull off.
Yeah. My stepmom is from, I believe she was from Mississippi, and in Mississippi, at least with her accent, they add syllables to single syllable words. So it'd be like, this wall right here is made of brick. Like brick gets two syllables.
Brick.
It's, yeah, brick.
It's cement.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true. You can stretch it out.
You know, I would never expect you to remember this because it was quite a few years ago. But I, because you were Hawkman on the Batman series.
Yeah.
And I played Green Arrow.
Were you really?
I was. And there was one recording session where Andre Romano was the casting, like casting.
Oh, yeah.
The voice director. And it was so much fun because we were everyone was in a room at the same time and it wasn't just one at a time. And it was so much fun to do the show that way.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
I thought you looked familiar.
Yeah. Do you do a ton of voiceover?
I don't do it that much anymore. I narrate, funny enough,
yeah,
Appalachian Outlaws for the History Channel.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that show. It's about ginseng harvesting in the Appalachian Mountains.
No, but I'm going to watch the shit out of it now.
It's really cool. And I do. I don't do like a standard narration. It is slightly, you know, with the southern tonality to it, and it works pretty good. I'm pretty happy with it.
But your voice is good because you can. You could dip down into the husk. You can get down there a little bit.
Well, that one is in Appalachia, the ginseng season only lasts 3 months out of the year.
That's,
yeah. It's that kind of thing.
I didn't even realize that ginseng was an industry of
it's
the Appalachian.
It's a huge,
mountains.
Huge black market industry, and the show is really interesting because these guys go up and do it, and they're going on other people's lands, and they're poachers, and it's, you know, it's kind of like in the moonshine realm,
right?
You know, and
you can just fucking shoot people on your property.
People are shooting people. There's, yeah, a lot of guns. There's a lot of things. They're blowing up stuff. It's pretty crazy.
Is this a current Appalachian,
yeah,
ginseng trade?
Yeah.
It's not like the old, like in the old days. This is like
this
now.
Is now. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And the more. You know, the braver you are, the more risk you'll take, and then guys getting themselves into all sorts of trouble. It's pretty neat. You know, I'm sure they stage some of it, but
Does the show follow a regular group of characters?
Yeah.
Okay. It does.
Yeah. 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 It's I wish I could remember the producers' names, but they're a really great team, and the footage they get is just amazing because it's up in Appalachia. Nobody really knows what goes on up there. You know?
I know it does sort of seem like.
It's like going to the bottom of the ocean.
I was thinking the same thing. It's like there's just like there's probably creatures up there that no one's ever seen.
No.
It's like,
what the hell is that?
It's a colossal squirrel or something, yeah, that you've never seen. But it's like where they have squirrels the size of bears up in the Appalachia Mountains.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I enjoy doing it a lot. How did I get on that?
We were talking about voiceover because you were Hawkman.
That's it. And I've done them over the years, but I've just been so busy with the theatrical part of my career that I don't,
yeah,
really have time to do it.
Yeah.
And finding time to do, you know, I'm missing out on job opportunities because I'm already booked on something else. You,
yeah,
know, and that's so crowded that I don't really know how I can squeeze more time. I'm sure your days are very crammed yourself.
They're crammed, but you know, like it's still. But you also, because you have a family and you have,
yeah,
and you have work. I don't have that. I don't have a wife or kids, and so I feel like that. When people go, how do you get so much stuff done? It's like, well, because all of my time is mine, so I don't. You know, like,
yeah,
there isn't anything. Like, if I were married, of course, and I had kids, I wouldn't do as much work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it really, I'm amazed at people who have a full career and a family. Like,
yeah,
that, the family stuff is just 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I'm really lucky with the current job I'm doing now. I'm actually here in L.A. filming.
The Dust Till Dawn series?
But that's actually in Texas.
Okay.
And the one I'm filming here is Scorpion.
Scorpion.
This new show for CBS.
Yeah, I've been seeing the billboards for
and
it.
Yeah, it's they're really marketing it well. Filmed over here at Manhattan Beach Studios.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, for instance, doing From Dusk Till Dawn, I was in Texas living there for 6 months. And that's hard because you miss your wife and kids.
Yeah.
And then trying to, you know, I did do the Appalachian Outlaw voiceovers while I was down there. But to try and do, like, cartoons and other
stuff,
it's really, really difficult.
You really have to pick your... It's, I mean, it is a nice... There is a nice reward in that when you, you know, if you're a struggling actor for a while and then all of a sudden you get to a point where you're like, I don't have time to do that project. Like, that's such a great feeling of, like, you know, you want to do... Because your instinct is, I got to take everything because I don't know when I'm going to work. And you're like, no, I'm okay. I'm working. I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great feeling when you get to that point, you know, and I'm enjoying it. And it's just a great time to be an actor right now. There's so many opportunities in television and film that really, if you're not working, you know, I mean, I find that hard to believe. There's just so many different outlets and places to go with great writing, so many channels and shows that are being produced right now. So if you're an actor out there, you should be working, you know? I mean, it's a great time.
I know you started working a handful of years before T2, but was that really the thing that, like...
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I came out here, man. I came out here in 1984. I wanted to get into the movie business. I didn't know a soul. I lived in my car. Some of the blocks around here I slept in, you know. Auditioned for a play, got to play, and the next thing you know, while I was doing that, Roger Corman, a buddy of mine, was working down at Roger Corman Studios in Venice Beach. I auditioned for this biker movie, 1984, got it, and that director recommended me to another director, and I was off to the Philippines. I did like 6 or 7 movies for Corman before I got my SAG card or an agent.
Oh, wow.
And then I got them both simultaneously and did another play. And auditioned for Die Hard 2. It was the first big movie I auditioned for after I'd had an agent. And I got that part, got cast on the spot. And then right after that, I did another play, and T2 came along, and I got that.
That poor John McClane just has the worst luck with terrorists. Everywhere he goes.
Yeah, terrorists. That first movie, Die Hard, was just phenomenal.
And unlike anything else, I mean, that was one of those,
it's,
did you see this fucking movie, and they blow up? And then... the cast was phenomenal.
Yeah,
and
it was so well done. Who was Alan Rickman?
Alan Rickman. Yeah. This is really the first exposure we had to Alan Rickman.
Yeah, and he was so great in that movie. Everybody was great in that
movie. Bruce McClane.
Bruce was fantastic.
He was great. He was really great because he had kind of bopped around a little bit because Moonlighting was huge.
Sure.
And it was a time when it was less common for TV people to cross over to film. They were very separate islands. And some, he did this, I think maybe it was this movie Blind Date with John Larroquette and Kim Basinger, and that did well.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, Die Hard was the thing that just, that was the thing that made him, like, a movie star. But I think he was still doing Moonlighting at the same time. So
yeah, I think you're right. He might have farmed out to do that.
I mean, he's been a movie star for like 30 years now, which is crazy. It's crazy to think about that.
It's true.
But what's the other part of the longevity, do you think? Because you seem like a super friendly guy, and I feel like that's really important in this bit. Because like, if someone recommends you, oh, you got to work with this guy. That you know, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you're an asshole to people, then it's sooner or later that's going to run out.
Yeah, my father kind of instilled in me that, you know, you want to be a guy that people want to work with, not around.
Mm.
And you can approach that by being prepared, being professional. And that carried over into my career as an actor. And you just go into every job and you try to treat people like you would want to be treated yourself, you know, until they prove to be an asshole.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you treat me well, I'll treat you better. You know, it's that kind of a thing. And, you treat me bad and, you know, So I've just sort of been like that, and I think that if you work hard and you know you show up, and you, it's a real easy job. You show up, hit your mark, be on time, and be prepared, and it should all take care of itself. You know?
It should, but you know it's a business where that brings a lot of baggage around it too. You know, there's a lot of. I mean, of all the businesses I can think of, I think it's, you know, besides, let's say, you know, athletics. But even in athletics, people are from a very early age who are successful professional sports people were, they did that in school and they were successful at it.
Right.
But acting is one of those things where all of a sudden your life can change and the landscape of your life is dramatically different and you might not be prepared for it. And so if you have weird issues, that may not make them better, you know? Mm-hmm. But it attracts a really, you know, some people don't approach it that way. And I feel like guys who sort of approach it like it was a job, you know, it's a job. Yeah. And you show up and you're respectful and you do this and you do your job and you go home. Those seem to be the happiest people in business.
I agree. I'm an artist and I know I'm an artist and I know I'm a craftsman and you know I've had this conversation with other actors. I won't sit here and name drop, but the ones that really approach it that way. I mean, it's something that you can continue to evolve at. You're never going to master it. You're never going to make it. It's never going to be perfect. You're always striving to do something. So that's what keeps it really interesting. And then the rest of the stuff, just the way you treat people. I think that's kind of how you're raised.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's your parents. I mean, it's you know, or the environment you came from. I mean, if you're decent, you know, it'll show that way.
You came from a big family, right? You have a big
I'm the head of five. The oldest of five kids, and it's a crazy, crazy, wonderful family. We're all nutty, but you know there was a work ethic that was passed down. So,
and your brother's a musician, right?
He is. He was in the band Nine Inch Nails.
He was in Nine Inch Nails, but he was in Filter too, right?
And he is the man behind. He's the creative guy behind Filter.
Yeah.
Guitars for Nine Inch Nails, and then he was actually living with me. We were living out in North Hollywood, California, my wife and I. And
near the NoHo Arts District.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story, Chris. You'll like this.
Okay,
we were living at the Hollywood Tower apartment on Franklin and Argyle.
Yeah,
you know the one right across from Cafe 101.
Yeah,
you're very, very cool place. When I was living there, was nothing but Playboy bunnies, and Josh Brolin was up in the penthouse. I mean, he was living up in the penthouse. He wasn't living with the Playboy bunnies, but you know,
I'm sure probably paid him a visit.
I don't know. There was something maybe, but Trent Reznor, my brother. It was very exciting times because they were touring. They'd been touring for 4 years on that Pretty Hate Machine record,
yeah.
And I had done Die Hard 2. And gotten T2 while they were touring. So we were both kind of like, da-da-da. And as a matter of fact, I'd gone to Jim Cameron and said, there's this great band that I know about, that you're going to know about if you don't know about them yet. But if we put their music in our movie, it'll be phenomenal. And it's a band called Nine Inch Nails, and it's industrial rock. And he kind of looked at me and said, I never heard of them. And I said, yeah, that's the point. They're cresting right now. They're going to be... And they ended up going with Guns N' Roses because Arnold liked Guns N' Roses, and I kept saying, no, this song had like a hole. I've been listening to it while I train while I'm training as the T-1000. I'm listening to nothing but Nine Inch Nails, and these guys, you know. So anyway, they get big, and all that happens at the same time. But I remember Trent Reznor, my brother, coming into my apartment at Hollywood Towers. And sitting down and saying, we're exhausted. We've been looking for a house where we're going to move in and we're going to record the record. We think we found it. And he goes, Trent goes, here's a picture of it. And he hands me Helter Skelter. And I open it up. And he's got, you know, posted the Sharon Tate house.
Oh, my God.
And I look down. And there it is. And I go, you got to be kidding me. And he goes, no. Think of the marketing. Think of the publicity. Think of, you know, it's the place. And it was like, so, wow, man, for real? Okay. Well, you guys are, you know, I can, you know.
And did they end up going there?
They did. They moved in. And they started recording. he set the recording up in the room where this horrible thing happened.
My God.
Shut up, Kyle. So they said
finally someone else said it.
So they set it up right there. And I went up to visit my brother, and I was kind of, you know, he'd been touring with those guys for 4 years. And I, you know, I'm you know, I've known Trent from Cleveland, and you know, I knew these guys, and I'm up there kind of walking around and feeling like a big brother worried about his little brother and checking out what's going on. And man, the vibe up there, you know, it was just intense. Anyway, to wrap the story up, my brother, a couple of months later, comes back and says, I'm done. I'm out of the band. I'm just done. I can't live up there anymore. I've been up there for, you know, whatever it was, 6 months. I think I'm going, you know, it's really affecting me. I just can't be there. And I said, so what are you going to do? And he goes, well, I've got this demo I did of this song, Hey Man, Nice Shot,
yeah,
that I wrote in Mom's garage.
Oh, my God.
My parents, actually, it was my parents, where they lived in North Carolina. They were living in North Carolina. I've got this song. And I said, well, let me hear it. And I played it. And I went, damn, Richie. I mean, this is fucking great. You know, I've never heard anything quite so intense. You did this in Mom's basement? And he goes, yeah. I go, dude. And I handed it to Brian Whitten and... oh my God, I'm blanking. Alan Schechter, who's no longer with us. Anyway, he was working with Joel Silver, and Joel Silver I had worked with Die Hard 2, and I knew these guys from. And they took that song, and they gave it to Joel, and Joel put it in the Demon Knight soundtrack. And my brother got a record deal with Warner Brothers for 7 records, Jesus. Just like that. Based on a demo he had done, an 8-track demo of Hey Man, Nice Shot. And I'll tell you what, the release, the single of Hey Man, Nice Shot is essentially what I heard that day. You know how powerful that song is.
Well, yeah.
Is history.
I worked at K-Rock at the time when that song came out.
Did you?
I did. And that song was in heavy, heavy rotation.
Yeah.
Like, we would... I always knew that a song was... that they were pushing the shit out of a song, and it was big when... in a four-hour shift, the song would come up twice. It would come up at the beginning of the shift, and it would come up at the end of the shift. That meant that, like, if a song came up twice in a couple hours, that meant heavy, heavy rotation. And Hey Man, Nice Shot had a great lifespan at K-Rock.
Yeah, it's my brother's been living off that for years. So, he came back with another. He had another big hit too. I love my brother. Take a Picture was another great hit. So he's got more than one. He's got some great music he's been doing out there, and he's still touring. And
well, wait a minute,
great soundtracks and.
Wait a minute. So Take a Picture at the end. He goes,
hey, Dad.
What do you think about your son now? And I'm like, that guy has issues.
Well, what'd I tell you about my family? Right? It's a wonderful, very loving family, but it's kind of nutty. We're all kind of nutty. And yes, we all have a little issue.
When you hear a song about that, do you call me to go, you doing okay, buddy?
Yeah, I do. I do. How you doing, little brother?
Yeah, you doing okay.
He's a good guy. I love that kid. He's so talented too, man.
What's the age difference between you guys?
10 years.
Oh, 10 years. Okay.
So it's interesting. I don't know. Did you come from a large family?
No, I'm an only child, basically.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, when I was leaving to go to Hollywood, you know, this is after a couple of failures in my life.
Sure.
You know, I went away to college. I went to play football. I quit football. I quit college. I kicked around in Ohio. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I kept going back to this crazy idea. I wanted to be an actor. I had acted as a child in plays and stuff. And I don't know where it came from, but it just kept coming back. This is what you want to do. This is what you want to do. And you don't know anybody, and you don't know how you're going to get started in Hollywood. So who do you know? What do you do? You know what I mean?
Right.
So anyway, my brother, funny story. He'll deny this if you ever have him on this podcast. I never remember. He came, and I remember being in my mom and dad's kitchen. He looked at me, he goes, this is hysterical. He was like 10 or 13 or something. You're going to go out to Hollywood, and you're going to fall flat on your ass. You're going to get involved in drugs, and you're going to get in porn, and you're going to get all this crazy shit's going to happen to you. You can't do this. You can't leave. You know, he was so scared about me going and just heard all this negative stuff. And I just looked at him, and I said to him, and I remember it, someday you might be able to make a living with your guitar. And I left. And, you know, the rest is the rest. I mean, it's, he's
you set an example.
Exactly. I went out and said, you know, you can give this a shot. There's nothing to be afraid of. Go try. But, anyway, that's kind of a very personal story.
It's a good.
I told you.
It's a good.
I'm embarrassed, Sue.
No, it's a good story because
Sue, what are you laughing at over there? My publicist is laughing at me. I love it.
It's a good story because particularly at that time. I mean, now I sort of feel like people don't really have any excuses to pursue things because you can put stuff on the internet. It's very easy to just make your own thing. But at that time, when you came out here in '84,
yeah,
how the fuck do you get started? Like, where do you? Because you. It's just the concept of getting a demo reel is expensive. Making video, making tape, it's expensive.
I had no idea any of this. I was like oblivious to this. It was ignorance was bliss.
It's probably better that you didn't know because you would have gone, oh, there's no fucking way.
Yeah, if I would have known how tough it was, I don't know if I would have done it. I understand my parents looking at me just petrified,
right,
at the idea that I was going to go to Hollywood. I mean, your father, I have no way to help you.
Yeah,
I know. This is my deal. I want to do this. You know, it's a little bit of that kind of.
What did
hey,
he
Dad,
do?
What do you think about me now?
Yeah. what did your dad do?
He was he's a successful guy. He worked for Lockheed Aircraft Corporation. Then he went to MIT. He got his master's from MIT. He's a Sloan Fellow.
Oh wow.
And I know I put off a very blue-collar vibe, but, my dad went into banking. And I kind of grew up all over the Midwest. He would go to different banks, and he was an executive and did all right for himself.
What was your favorite town?
Oh, I love Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I really love Atlanta. I did love going to high school in Detroit, though. And Detroit's very dear to my heart. It's a badass city, and it's really suffering right now. But I love Detroit. Yeah, I had some great times there, and all the places I lived. Boston was cool. Dayton was cool. It was all cool.
Detroit gets a bad rap, but I think it's just a piece of Detroit that actually is
downtown.
Yeah, but all the other I just performed there.
You do stand-up, right?
I do.
Damn, you do it all, bro.
I like to stay busy.
you're afraid to stop.
I can't stop.
You can't stop, can you?
I'm like the plot of the movie Speed. I can't slow down. Yeah. If I slow down, I'm going to explode.
Seriously, I'm curious, though. Like, how much sleep do you get?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that because I've just recently realized I sleep for 5 hours exactly. No more, no less. I sleep for 5 fucking hours, and I can't... I was so tired. I hadn't had a day off in a month, and I finally get a day off, and I woke up at 6 a.m. Like,
you can't.
Like, no!
You can't help yourself.
And I try to force myself to go back to sleep, but there's nothing.
But you have so many things going on. I mean, because I see you, you host that show, the after thing.
Yeah, Talking Dead.
And, and stand-up and
this other all this Nerdist stuff, which is fun.
Are you acting at all? Are you doing any?
No, no one ever asked me to do that. And it's not someone would have to come along and say like, hey, do you want to be in this cool thing? And I'd have to go, sure. But for me to go out, I don't love the audition process.
Right.
And I'm so busy with other things that for me to start trying to act in film now would be really silly, I think.
Right.
And time-consuming. And so someone would have to really just go,
I understand
you
that.
Be in this. And then I'd go, okay, if it's cool, I'll do it. But
that's the first hurdle that young actors need to get over.
Auditioning?
Well, and I'm going to say it from this point of view, that it's actually a chance to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So any young actor that's out there listening, it's a chance to do a part that you might not ever get to do. So it's a performance, and you should look at it from that point of view. You should, and this is how I've done it over the years. I'm going to go in and be the best I can be at this role and take it as if there's cameras rolling and just go for it. And it's worked.
Fuck, where were you in the 90s, man? I mean, I know where you were.
But I learned that. I learned that.
To me, it was just an opportunity to go get rejected by a mildly interested casting director who was angry about things that had nothing to do with me.
Well, I ran into those people too. But I mean, you try to you know, elevate, you know, at least the concept of what's going on. And, I learned that from a acting coach that I still work with. You know, you've got to get past that thing. And once I did, now I don't audition anymore, but...
Well, getting over that hurdle is actually part of the test as to whether or not... Because I think if you can still make something come alive with reading opposite someone who's read it a million times and just wants to go home,
yeah.
And you can still somehow... Because it really is, in its best form, it's a chemistry that happens. And it's like, I feel like what you do in the room is probably not the same as what you're going to do on the set because you're surrounded by different people with different chemistry. Mm-hmm. And so I'm guessing. And so if you can still do a good job where someone's reading their lines like this, you know, then that's an accomplishment. Like that weeds out a lot of people, I think. Mm-hmm. And I got weeded out time and time again.
Well, you have to take the power back as an actor. You have to turn the circumstances around so you're not the one that's being auditioned.
How do you do that?
You make them the ones that are being auditioned.
Well, I never even thought to. I didn't even know how to do that.
Yeah, it's just reverse it all up. It's like I'm actually auditioning the director.
Oh, that's...
Here's how I'm going to do it. This is the way I'm going to do it. Let's see how you react to that, you know? You just got to change it up a little bit. I don't want to divulge too many of my secrets. There's a lot of them out there.
No,
but it's all
you don't have to audition anymore.
For the record, though, Chris, I'm on the record. My agents know this. My manager knows this. I will audition.
They just don't make you. You get to get offered good stuff.
But I will.
Yeah.
And I still have that out there, that if there's something I want to do and there's something you think I should do and if it's something I really want to go after, I got no qualms with that.
Yeah.
I'm an actor. That's what I do. I mean, it's not beneath me.
That's good.
And I can't tell you how many roles I've gotten as a result of having that attitude.
Well,
because people go like, what do you mean? The guy will read? Yeah, I'll read with the director anywhere, anytime. You name the place, baby, I'm there.
I think a lot of people, I'm probably one of those people, just hate the audition process so much. They're like, oh, if I don't have to do this anymore, I'm not going to fucking read it, you know. But that's the difference between, you know, that's the craftsman part coming in of like, I want to dive into every piece of this and dissect it and do it and understand it and learn it. Because, you know, again, maybe it's something you don't want to do once you audition for it. You go, oh, you know, actually, this didn't feel
like...
Then you should have gone.
You know what I mean? I mean, if you're not going to stand behind your work, why go through the motion?
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that before as well, where it's you know, over the years. I mean, I've been doing this 30 years. And some say I'll read it and go like, you know, this is a piece of shit. I don't respond to this. It doesn't affect me. I read this. Why am I doing this?
Yeah. Did you do that before you really had the luxury of picking and choosing things?
No. No. You're clawing your way in, baby. You're going for it. Anything and everything, you know.
Yeah.
Anything and everything. But that's how you learn. That's how you get the experience you need, you know.
What was the...
I think that's true of every actor out there. You got to figure out your way to get in there.
Of course.
I mean, you go back and look at any actor's career over the years, they started somewhere,
right.
You know, doing something, and it wasn't where they're at now. You know, you have to claw your way into the business and be ready when the opportunities present themselves, and then not choke, you know, when you read Jim Cameron's script and go, oh, my God, I'm the new fucking Terminator. I mean, you know. Jesus Christ. I went in and I threw that script down on his desk and said, I can do this. And I said that partly to convince myself I could do this after, you know, you're about to do the screen test for it. And you're realizing this is the opportunity of a lifetime and I hope I don't blow it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So what was that?
He didn't actually let me read the script until after I'd already done these improvisational auditions for him and they had filmed them. Then they let me read the script.
Oh, so they you Terminator improvised? What did you do?
I created what you saw.
What did they give you a setting?
Create an intense presence.
That's fantastic.
That was the audition.
And
what you see in the movie is what I did in that audition. And how I knew to do what I was doing, I have no idea.
Well, I guess it was just the right thing.
It was the right thing at the right time. I mean, I know what I was thinking when I was doing it. I can relive that, you know. I mean, there was all sorts of things. I was like, you immediately went into the predator world, like, you know, how do animals look? And wow, I mean, if I slow myself down, look real stealthy like a shark, it'll be cool. You know, and I was just free flowing, just going, and they were rolling on me. And I thought I was like an Indian, like, you know, sensing somebody was near me, you know, and just slowed it all down and made it more still.
That's really fun.
And that's what grabbed him.
That's fun to go opposite. Like, I think because a lot of people's intuition would be like, I got to be intense, you know?
Yeah.
But slowing everything down, or like, you know, when you're trying to get a loud room to listen to you, is to talk quieter so everyone has to come in. It's like, that's not my impulse. My impulse is always to be like, listen to me, you know?
Hey,
I'm a Terminator. I'm going to beat you up, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not, it's really interesting to take the, because I feel like in a lot of cases, the opposite choice can work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you're in the gray area in between where you haven't decided, but if you make a really strong decision, you know, and you're really committed to that, mm-hmm. to that choice, that there's a lot of different ways, you know, that you can attack a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever?
And you hope it's right. I mean, every time you go do a job or any other audition that, you know, actors have out there, you got to have some choices made up. You've got to commit to something. Even if they adjust it while you're in the room, you still have got to, you know, commit to something, like you're saying.
Yeah. And does it...
I'm just repeating what you're saying.
No, that's okay. It makes me feel like sometimes I actually make points that make sense.
Absolutely right.
But have you ever been in a situation where, you know, you go in with a character in the audition and they go, great. And then you get on set and the director's like, okay, now different, you know, and it's not at all what you brought in.
Yeah. But if you've, I think that if you've done your work, you've already thought about so many different scenarios, you're kind of prepared to go different ways. I mean, like I said before, I still work with a coach. I mean, I have a guy that if I'm feeling I need an extra brain to look at what I'm doing and help me explore some other avenues that I'm not thinking of, I'll bring him in and look it over and work on stuff before I show up to go to work. That's kind of my job. My prep work is my business. You know what I mean? When I show up. So I like to try to have different, you know, directions to go with something in case somebody says, you got to do something different. It's very rarely ever happened to me. I'll get like a very adjustment this way or that way, you know, like, maybe try it this way where it's, you know, whatever the adjustment would be, but, and you'll, but that, you know, if you're really working with a director, like Jimmy Mangold, we were talking earlier about shooting in Memphis. He directed Walk the Line. He also directed Copland. Those are two of my favorite performances I've ever done. And he's one of my favorite directors I've ever worked with because, we just work really well together. He's always been able to communicate to me specifically what he wants in a way that I really respond to. So I feel every time I work with him, it's a real collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't always feel that way with some directors, you know. It's an opportunity you look for, you know, a director that you trust his taste and direction and vision of what he's trying to do. You know?
Because
they're two totally distinctly different characters. One's a New York cop, badass cop guy, and then the other's Johnny Cash's daddy, you know?
Yeah. Because you don't know, because some, you know, in some cases, you know, the actor is a little more in control or the performer is a little more in control. In other cases, you kind of hope the director's in control and knows what they're doing, because basically you don't exactly know what he's shooting or how exactly he's going to lay it out. So you have to you need to be able to trust him.
You got to be able to trust the guy, you know.
So because you're the one that's going to...
It's your ass on the line.
Absolutely.
Your ass on
the
line.
When people think of... I think when people judge directors, they don't necessarily think performances. They go, oh, the shots were weird. It was edited. It looked weird. They don't go, oh, he maybe didn't give that actor the best, you know, environment to shine in or didn't pick the best takes. It's usually going to be like, that guy, set actor sucks, you know, like you're going to take the heat for all of the performance related stuff.
Yeah, it's so true. And you've got to be able to pick through and figure out quickly, is this somebody I trust and I want to work with. And I go back from film to TV so much that there's just some directors that I respond to and some guys I kind of keep myself a little bit more guarded. And mm-hmm. No matter what they say, I kind of resist and keep going the path that I'm going, the way I'm going with it, you know. And make them I don't want to reveal too much of how I approach that. But, you know, there's some guys that you know, Daniel Espinosa is another director mm-hmm. I worked with in Safe House.
Mm-hmm.
This guy had I wasn't prepared for the specifics of how he saw this character, wasn't prepared for some of the ideas he had, just because I didn't really realize he was that deep of a director, per se. I mean, I don't know why I underestimated his ability to work with actors, but he was amazing, and he had great ideas. And I would just stand there and go, God damn, I'm, you know, why the fuck didn't I think of that? That's a great way to go. Let's do that. You know what I mean? So you still got to be open.
Yeah.
Because it may come from somebody you wouldn't expect it to come from.
But I think a lot of it, what you said, I think really kind of resonates because I always thought of acting as like, oh, that's the thing you do on set, you know, like that's the, but you're like, no, all the work's in the prep. And I never approached it that way.
Yeah.
Never thought of it that way. It's like you have to be, all your work has to be mostly done by the time you get there so that you're just basically just reciting this thing, you know, that you've already figured out.
Yeah.
While being flexible at the same time.
Absolutely. All the work that I do for my stuff is the stuff I do up at my compound up there in my office, banging my heads on the wall, you know, and if, like I said, if I want to bring somebody in, I'll work with him and we'll go over it, and I do it by myself, and you just try it different ways, and then you just walk on a set and try to be confident and deliver, you know, and it's, acting's really about the confidence thing, you know. I mean, if you're not confident standing in front of a camera, it's going to show.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? There's only one way. You got to be prepared.
Right.
You got to know you're ready.
Confident people seem to at least, even if they're lying to themselves, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. As long as they believe it.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's what I'm talking about, because that's what matters, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people think of confidence as a sort of like this, for lack of a better term, a filter that goes up where you go like, oh, I'm really awesome. But that's a result. The confidence is a result
of all the hard work.
Of all the hard work and being comfortable with yourself and knowing that you know what's going on and that you have options if you need them. And so it's not like you know, I think that's where people fuck up, is that, you know, they think that confidence is this thing where you're like, hey everybody, I'm fucking great, you know?
That's arrogance.
That's arrogance. Yeah. They confuse confidence and arrogance as opposed to just being comfortable with who you are, you know. Because I would imagine that you could get really intimidating really fast by just sort of slowing down and just kind of looking at someone and going, I don't know if I really want to do it that way. And then they might go, oh, shit, as opposed to getting in someone's face. You know?
Absolutely. That's how it works.
That's sort of a Southern trait, I think, of the guy that just sort of like, what was it that you were just talking about a minute, you know? And I'm like, oh, I don't. Then you start to get really uncomfortable. When you slow down, it changes the dynamic.
Still waters run deep.
Yeah.
How many times you hear that growing up?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the truth, too. Yeah, I fall back on that on a regular basis.
Do you like working on a television? Do you like the schedule of the television show? Scorpion probably feels a lot like working on a movie, though, that just goes on and on.
Yeah, I love what's going on in the business right now, because I am able to jump back and forth, and there's so many great things going on. The stories that are being told on television, and this story by Nick Santura and Nick Wooten and, you know, all these guys that are involved with Orsi and Kurtzman, they're great stories. They're really, really interesting. And it's a longer visit with that character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is like one big long movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick will be how to stay engaged with your character and take him on that journey, however long. And that's determined by, you know, the ratings. but you're getting a new story to tell with that character. It's a neat thing. I mean, excuse me, the longest run I've had on TV was The Unit.
Oh, that was such a great show.
Oh, thanks, man.
Oh, man, I fucking loved The Unit.
Yeah, it was fun.
I don't know why I forgot about it. I fucking loved The Unit.
That's cool.
That was such a badass show.
It was fun, yeah. It was a lot of fun. And that was Mamet and Sean Ryan, and they had great, great stories. And the characters really developed and evolved, and you stayed engaged with it. And that's about the longest I've ever worked consecutively on TV. The other ones have been like The Sopranos was like 3 episodes, X-Files was 2 years, Unit, and what else do they do? It is From Dusk Till Dawn, Last Resort,
I mean, X-Files is, I mean, that's kind of a, so you must have worked with Vince Gilligan.
Vince, X-Files. I love. Vince, yeah, he's got, has he been in here?
Yeah. Vince has been on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Isn't he great, his voice?
He's the best.
Chris. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
You would never.
Well, you know, we can't, I can't do him, but you know that he's got a great Virginian accent. Isn't he a Virginian?
I don't know if he's from, but let's say he is.
I think he's Virginian.
But such a wonderful, affable, brilliant man.
Amazing.
With the most gorgeously dark stories brewing inside his mind.
Isn't it? It's something else. But he was, what a great writer he was.
How the fuck
X-Files.
Do you come onto the X-Files and it's like, when you know, like, you know, with fucking Fox Mulder, and then it's like, okay, well, the guy that everyone's crazy about is not going to be there anymore, and then you got to step into that, or you're like, ah, shit. Or do you feel like, no, this is a challenge. I can do this.
Yeah, Chris, think back to the time. The internet was new.
Right.
Al Gore had not invented the internet.
He hadn't thought of it yet.
He had thought of it. It was new. And I remember when I got the opportunity, I thought this was great. My little boy was about to be born. I'd had my daughter was 2 or 3. You know, she was 3 or 4. Anyway, I was going to be working in Los Angeles. Nice steady gig. I didn't have to worry about, you know, where's the next gig. That's the cool thing about TV. It's a nice steady run, and it takes a little bit of that stress away. But Chris gave me the opportunity. Said, "Hey, we want to bring you in with this new character, Chris Carter." And I had met him for something before, talking about auditions. I had met him before, and I'd read for, I think it was Harsh Realm.
Oh, right.
And he didn't cast me,
motherfucker.
But the audition went so well, he immediately thought of me to replace David.
That's why you should never feel bad if you don't get a role. If you do a good job, then it and you're nice to people, it still can happen.
God has a way of taking care of you. It works out the way it's supposed to work out. So he gave me that role, and then, you know, yeah, I mean, I was very apprehensive. I mean, people love David, and, you know, shit, you're standing there looking at this, you know, starting this up, and God, why are they all over my ass about this? I haven't even done a goddamn thing, and they're all like pissed off. They don't want me to come do it, and don't they know I just want to try to help keep the series going,
right,
for a couple more years,
right?
That's what they said to me. Couple more years,
yeah.
You know, we're gonna try to keep it going. Why are the fans turning on me? I didn't even do anything. You know what I mean?
Because nerds hate change. And, you know, I'm telling
I'm speaking to the nerd community
exactly.
Right now.
If Duchovny had come in and you were first, they would have been like, fuck this guy. This piece of shit was on Red Shoe Diaries. He's going to come on and be on X-Files now and replace Robert Patrick. Bullshit. Like, it just changes back. Like, people, it fucks with their... Because in a world that feels very... where we just feel constantly out of control, and we, you know, like, we're always trying to find something to hold on to. When our entertainment is where people hook in a lot of their, like, as long as I can rely on this,
right,
I feel okay at the end of the day.
Right.
And when that changes, it's like my world, my ground beneath my feet, you know? So that's what it is. People just hate having, but then, you know, then they come, you always know, like, you know, you're going to get upset for a minute, but if you just stick around, it's all going to be okay, and you're going to fall in love with this new character, and everything's going to be okay.
And that's where the Vince Gilligan and Chris Carter were so smart with the way they handled the character. Because the first scene, I don't know if you recall, I don't know if you're an X-Files fan, but the first scene is me. I love it when he does that.
I was a fan.
Was Jillian throwing water in my face. That was my first scene. She throws water in my face when I start asking questions about David Duchovny or Fox Mulder. And I think at that point, then the audience went, oh, that's what I wanted to do to that guy anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then they kind of were a little bit more accepting. But it was, you know, it was from the get-go. It was never said I was there to replace anybody.
Right.
I was just there to be a new character, and David was going to take a little hiatus. And they did bring him back. He actually directed an episode I did. Actually, maybe two. We got to act together, which was great. He's a wonderful actor.
Oh, yeah.
Great director.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I love the opportunity. Jillian was wonderful. She was very, warm and, you know,
gracious. I would watch the... It's FX. Is it run on FX?
I think it's on El Rey. It's on Robert Rodriguez's network. El Rey has the full
nine seasons
of the X-Files. It's also on Chiller. Do you watch it ever occasionally?
I mean, the DVR picks it up, so it's like sometimes I just forget what channel, whatever's on. But it's
so many channels now.
So many fucking channels. Man. but it's fun because the one thing that I love about, like, the title sequence, first of all, is just like, it's, but besides that, but the graphics and everything, it's like, this feels so 90s. And the show, the stories hold up, but a lot of times it's like, I can't take my eyes off Gillian Anderson's shoulder pads. Like, it's those 90s jackets and Duchovny's kind of like, he's kind of got the pouty emo face, you know, like it's so 90s. But the stories totally hold up.
So hysterical. Vince wrote like one of the last episodes. I believe it was the Leave It to Beaver episode where we're in the Brady Bunch episode where we were in the Brady Bunch house. It was one of the wildest experiences I've ever had. I have to watch that again. I think he wrote that. He might have directed that as well.
Do you ever, if you're at home and something just pops on, do you ever watch and go, oh yeah, this? Do you ever?
I don't. I'll see something and I'll maybe watch like a couple of seconds, minutes of it, and then kind of go, I can't watch this.
Can you watch yourself or do you not like to?
Once or twice.
Right.
You know, once or twice. I do like to see if I achieve some of the things I was trying to achieve and, you know, be aware of what I'm doing. Or at least what I think, what I thought I was doing. And then after that, I can't really, because then I start really picking on myself. And
how do you know if
it's not good?
How do you define if you've done a successful job?
Well, if I can recall exactly what I was trying to achieve and if I feel like it came off that way. I mean, it's hard to, I think it's hard to articulate.
You just know.
Yeah, you get a real strong. And then you also watch stuff and you go, shit, I didn't do that right. Or they didn't use the right edit. And why didn't they, why did they take that take? And they trimmed that. And it was a better take when I was this. Or, I know why they didn't do that. You know, I kind of get into that thing. It's funny because acting is, I rely on everybody else. The crew, everybody, to get to do what I do. And ultimately, the performances, I give it away.
Yeah.
It's the directors, it's the editors, and they can either save me or destroy what I'm trying to do. So you've got to learn camera techniques that allow you to not get dropped on the editing room floor. And, you listen to other people in character. That works.
Yeah.
Because they'll cut back to you and, you know what I mean?
You get the head nod.
You got to kind of pay attention to what's going on. But anyway, ultimately you give it away and it's somebody else's art form.
Yeah.
And you're a part of it.
What do you do with your free time? Is anything that you like to do do you have free time at all these days?
I ride motorcycles.
Uh-huh.
And
you did some Sons of Anarchy too, right?
I did one. I was supposed to do some more this season, but Scorpion precluded that from happening, which is one of those instances where I referenced earlier where I wish I could do all the things that I get the opportunity to do because I love that show, and I love those guys working with them, and I fit right in. And I know Paris Barkley, the executive producer, and Billy Garrett, one of the directors. And I don't know Kurt that well, but I know he knows of me. I've met him a couple times, and I wanted to do that and be a part of it. That character was set up to come back this year.
Uh-huh.
So, but, Scorpion came along, and it's business-wise, you got to do what you got to do at the right time. And they started filming earlier, and I'm very happy with Scorpion. But, who knows down the road? Maybe I'll get to work with those guys in some other way.
So what kind of motorcycle do you ride?
I'm a Harley-Davidson guy.
Okay.
a big old bagger, and I got a Springer Custom. I actually ride and ride with a real motorcycle club, the Booze Fighters Motorcycle Club. It was founded in 1946 in Los Angeles, California, and I'm the boss of the chapter here in L.A.
Oh, shit.
So it's 2 years older than the Hells Angels.
Okay.
And a lot of the early Booze Fighters became Hells Angels after the 40s. My chapter is a nonprofit that raises money for disabled vets.
Nice.
And, you know, I've been involved with them for about 8 years. It's a drinking club with a motorcycle problem. It's Chris, it's like, do you play golf? Do you do it? You don't have any free time.
I don't have any free time.
So, but if you play golf,
sure.
Let's say, when I, my stress release is to go out and ride the motorcycle. I usually do a coast to coast trip once a year. And sometimes I go solo.
Yeah.
Most of the time I ride with a buddy of mine who's a Vietnam vet, and we'll ride into D.C. and we'll go to the Vietnam Wall for Memorial Day, and I'll go to Walter Reed and Bethesda and sort of tie in my USO involvement with this enthusiasm I have for motorcycles. And it's just a great way to get out and be alone and just the wide open country in your eyes and the romantic dreams in your head, to quote from Bruce Springsteen. It's just a great vibe. And if I was a golfer, you know, I would have joined like a golf club.
Right.
But I didn't. I joined a motorcycle club with a bunch of other
a golf club
crazy
where
motorcycle
if
enthusiasts.
Someone steps out of line, you beat the shit out of them with a 9-iron, and then you throw them out on the street. And you're like, don't come back to see the booze golfers again.
The booze golfers.
Yeah.
The booze golfers. That's funny. A lot of booze fighters do play golf.
They do play golf.
There's some booze fighters that
play
golf.
So you go cross country by yourself? You've done that before?
I have done it.
But I feel like I'd go prefer, crazy.
Well, it's lonely. It's, but that solitude is kind of very meditative, and it's, you know, it's very peaceful. You can really get lost in America.
Oh, I know. I've been across the country lots of times.
Yeah,
and, you know, and there's some really great. I always say to people that you should be a tourist in this country because there's so many interesting parts that you. I mean, like. I remember I was driving across country and came across this town called Hayes, Kansas that I never would have thought to go to. And it was a really cool town.
Yeah.
In the middle of Kansas.
Local music, yeah. Local restaurants. The people are great. You know, you put that full face helmet on and they don't know who they're riding next to. You know what I mean? And you're just out there in the country. It's pretty cool. I enjoy it. I've had a few, you know, experiences.
I'm sure.
You know, a flat on the Mexican border, 100 miles from Tucson.
Oh, shit.
Trying to figure out what to do there.
What'd you do?
Well, I had all these real big decisions to make. A, do I continue to ride? Or do I, you know, take my knife and cut the tire off and ride the rim?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any water. I got cigars. Why the fuck didn't I bring water? I don't have anything to eat. I don't have a protein bar. Why the fuck? What fucking idiot rides across the desert? It's 106 degrees, and you don't have water or a biscuit or something to eat or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You got Mexico over here. You got Tucson's 100 miles away. Now we're going to do, asshole.
What did you do?
And you stand there, and I will tell you, you stand there, and you know the feeling. Oh. Nature just rises up around you, and all of a sudden you're just standing there, you know, under God, going, oh my God, I'm so insignificant. I'm out in the middle. None of this, you know, this is pretty cool. It's actually it's kind of a cool experience to go through. So what did I do, Chris?
Yeah.
Of course, I remembered I had my cell phone.
Oh, good.
I had my AAA card. I got motorcycle coverage. Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if this will work. I had reception, called AAA, and had to sit there for, you know, several hours before Manuel showed up with the flatbed to take my bike into the Tucson Harley-Davidson and have it a new tire put on.
That's fantastic.
That's not a very you know, a lot of bikers would be out there in podcast land going, oh, wait a minute, what you should have done was taken off that back rim.
I wonder what our biker demographic is. You know, although listening to podcasts if you're riding across country is probably a good thing to do.
Well, I have the Harley Bagger, I'll do a little plug for Harley. I have Sirius Radio on it, so I can listen to like the E Street Channel the whole way, or Outlaw Radio. You can listen. You got 150-watt amp, and you can hear it.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool. You got navigation if you want. I mean, it's with all this technology, it's pretty easy. Yeah, you know, and I swear to you, when I do this, I don't take that much.
Yeah.
You know, I literally go like, all right, I need like, you know, six pairs of underwear, I'll get me there. And
yeah.
You know what I mean? You're sweating the whole time because it's hotter than hell.
And you have to, you're wearing leather, basically.
You got, and, you, when you, and you're wearing, you got your stuff to put on. I rode through a tornado in Sioux Falls, Idaho, which was very funny story. I was with my buddy New York Mike and Rusty, this other old biker guy, and we finally had to get off the road because we're literally hydroplaning and being blown off the road, and we pull off on this exit, and I swear to God, I'm not making this up. There was a huge billboard, white, and in bold black letters, it said, "Prepare to meet thy God."
Well, I guess this is it.
Got off this Stuckey's.
Stuckey's!
And it was abandoned.
Of course it was. It's
right?
A Stuckey's.
Because it's gone. They're gone. And we're literally standing there, and we're huddled up in this thing, and we've got our full face on and all our rain gear and shit, and we're watching debris starting to go. And we positioned our Harley so that they would be into the wind and literally closed them all down. And we're just sitting there watching the roof come off the old gas station.
Holy
and we're
shit.
Going, holy motherfuck, what we're going to do, you know. And I'm yelling at the guys, if this gets really bad, we got to run into one of those storm ditches over there, and we got to hunker down in there and kind of hang on, man. This is, you know, is it life or death kind of thing. That was amazing.
And then you remembered you had your cell phone, and then
in that case, you know, the cell phone
doesn't matter.
But then, Kansas, I've been through a snowstorm by myself, a tornado by myself. It was a bad hailstorm, and then the very next day, I'm riding through the Rockies, and it's snow. You know, and you're on a Harley riding through semis with semis, you know, like riding in their trail, and you got to get through the Rockies and out the Vail Pass. And
oh my God.
It's pretty cool,
that's
man.
Fucking terrifying.
But how else are you going to get, you know, those kind of experiences and all that?
Internet.
It feeds into your, feeds into
video
your
games.
Yeah, but this feeds into your craft and, you know.
No, listen, if I had the
gives
stones,
you experience.
If I had the stones to do it, I would, you know,
yeah.
Like, I mean, it sounds like, but. I go, I'd get up there and I'd just go, oh, fuck this. Why'd I do this? You know, like, can you just give me a ride back? I'd get in with a truck. I'd just take the bike. I don't give a shit anymore.
Well, the earlier question you had, sometimes I have to admit, sometimes you get on it and you're just kind of going like, why did I decide to do this again? Oh, yeah, that's right.
But I guess like if you stick it out, sometimes the rewards are revealed later.
It's
you gotta
it's
be patient.
Great
just like with acting, like anything.
Exactly.
You know? You just got to put your head down. By the way, pretty sure I met your son. Was he working on the Corolla show?
My son?
Yeah.
No, because he's only 14.
Oh, okay. Then no, I didn't mean. I thought
but
I'm
who did
Adam
you?
Corolla?
Yeah, no, I know Adam Corolla, but I don't know who somebody was claiming to be my son.
I thought I met a guy, and I thought he said, oh, yeah, Robert Mayer is my dad. Maybe I invented that in my head.
Well, I don't think I have a son old enough to be working on Adam Corolla, but I do have a 17-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son.
What if he's sneaking out at night to work on a podcast and you didn't even know it? Dad, I want to be a podcaster. Son, no!
He'd probably be pretty good. What do you think, Sue? He'd be good at it, right? He'd be good at it.
Do your kids have any interest in the business at all? Or do they?
Funny you should ask that,
what?
Chris.
What?
Interesting. Funny you should ask that. My daughter. She's studying at Strasbourg right now.
Oh, well, I guess so. That's pretty serious.
And college she's going to go to, she wants to study acting there. And she's gone away on some summer camps at Sarah Lawrence and done some drama stuff. I haven't, excuse me, I haven't really let her try to pursue it professionally. But she did do she was in a video that Baltazar Getty did. She did a little acting for him, and she's really good on camera. I've got her working with my coach as well, and I think she could have a huge career. And I'm at that point now where, you know, I want to let her be a teenager and finish school.
Sure.
I'm not so sure I want her to do it professionally, and yet I work with other professional young people like Madison Davenport, who played my daughter on From Dusk Till Dawn. And she's a wonderful, you know, wonderful young lady. And so I, you know, she's going to have to find her way, my daughter. But I want her to benefit from all the nepotism that I did not. I'll tell you that much.
You know what I mean?
So you're saying the banking industry did not help at all get you into film?
Yeah, that didn't help. That didn't help at all. Didn't help at all. But I'm going to do whatever I can to kind of help her, and hopefully you'll hear from her someday. Austin Patrick is her name.
Oh, that's like a superhero name.
It is, isn't it? Austin Jessica Patrick.
Austin AJ Patrick.
She got her name. Daddy got arrested in Austin, Texas.
What?
Going way back.
What?
Way back.
Did you shoot a man just to watch him die?
I didn't do that.
Okay.
I was drunk on 6th Street.
You can get arrested for that? I thought that was
public intoxication.
Oh, no. 6th Street. You're supposed to do that in Austin. Yeah, that's why it's there, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. This was... that's where she got her name.
Oh, that's...
She's really proud of that.
That's a good... Why were you in jail? Just they put you in drunk tank for the night?
I was there for 18 hours. My wife, too, actually. Actually, we were riding around. The real story wasn't 6th Street. The real story is we were riding around looking for a friend of mine who was getting married, and he lived in a hot and toddy part of, you know, a rich part of Austin, Texas. And we'd flown in for the wedding, and I was a broke, out-of-work actor. I think maybe I'd done Die Hard 2. Yeah, I had, because my wife and I were engaged. We weren't married. And we were having a hard time finding his place, and they thought we were casing the neighborhood. And I looked kind of like I look now, but a lot more vagrant-y. and they threw us in jail.
Oh, shit.
They thought we were casing the neighborhood, and the cops kind of separated me and the wife, and... She wasn't intoxicated, for the record. I was. That's why she was driving. And I went after him. I kind of, you know, and the next thing I know, I was up against the wall.
Yeah, that's not
being
a good
handcuffed
idea.
Handcuffed. I'm lucky I didn't really get, like, you know, something else, some other charge. But, yeah.
Well, let's see.
And the other reason she's named Austin is, of course, that was my character's name in T2.
Right.
And I didn't know if I was going to have another kid, so I said, we'll give her a cool name. Like
give her
Austin.
A cool name. Yeah, Austin, very special place for you.
Yeah.
Well, this is the end.
Dude, you're awesome.
Come on.
You are awesome, dude.
Dude, thank you. This was so much fun.
I'm thrilled we worked together, and thanks for reminding me of that.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this.
Well, I got so excited when I came in for that, because they were like, you're going to be Green Arrow, and I'm like, fuck yeah. And so I did 2 episodes, and when we showed up to that recording... I was like, oh, this is going to be great, and I'm sure there's going to be a spin-off. Like, I go to all these places.
Where sure.
And Andrea Romano walks in right before we start, and she was like, so this is going to be the last episode. The series is ending.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
No!
Yeah, no!
And that was the last episode. So they had everyone there. It was like, you know, Green Arrow and Hawkman, and like they had everyone there, like all of the, so it wasn't.
Aren't those fun?
They're great.
We didn't really talk about that. We talked a little bit about some of the voiceovers I were doing, but that's difficult acting.
You think so?
Voiceover acting?
I love it. I've been doing it for 10 years. I've been doing it for 10 years. Yeah.
My hat's off to you.
No, I just like...
I'm lost in there sometimes. I don't know how to do that because my stuff is so camera-oriented that I have a hard time getting to that place.
That's why you need someone like Andrea Romano, who's so good at telling you, like...
You got to be bigger.
Yeah, because there are... I feel like with voiceover, there are tricks that you can do to affect a performance that you couldn't get away with doing if someone was looking at you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, especially if you're really tired, but you got to sound like you're up. Like, you can still, it doesn't matter what your face is doing, you can still sound the way that you're supposed to sound. But it's to people like Andrea who, you know, single-handedly, like, she was responsible for, like, the original golden era of Warner Brothers would have been the Chuck Jones and Robert... Clampett years, but the second golden age of Warner Brothers animation was Andrea Romano, was like Animaniacs, you know, the original Batman series, the Batman, like all that stuff was, she did all the voices casting for all that. Yeah. So, you know, she's a legend.
Yeah, no, it's great that we had the opportunity to work with her.
So now
maybe that's one of the reasons I don't get to go back that much is because they have to really pull it out of me.
Well, tell old Cat McPhee that Chris Hardwick says hi.
Absolutely,
and,
my man.
And since we're talking about voiceover,
I would love it if you would sign off the podcast by just telling people in whatever manner you want, just say, enjoy your burrito. That's how we sign off the podcast.
Nerdist, enjoy your burrito.
Oh, he did the husk part. So good.
It's always better to go down.
You got
to
go down.
Down into the diaphragm. I think so.
It's nice.
When I start getting way up here with the acting.
Hey, kids, get off my goddamn lawn!
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code Nerdist.